Blog Talk Radio.
Pleasure to have you here. This is Dale Graham, and you're with Masonic Home Companion. Another hour or so of frolic into the mind of and body and soul of masonry. It's the 21st of December, isn't it? And this, as you know, is solstice. This is the day when, in our genes, somewhere there, our ancestors would dare to step out timidly to pay homage, to acknowledge the forces of the universe, and to fall to their knees in gratitude that the shortest day, the period of the longest night, had finally come, harboring the return of Sol. It occurs when the sun's daily maximum height in the sky is at its lowest, and the North Pole is tilted furthest away from the sun. When I hear that, I'm not really inspired, though. It sounds much more interesting if I'm thinking about the restoration of life on the face of the earth, and people realizing that all life comes from the sun. I know that we are better scientists in some ways, but I don't know if we can approximate the emotional impact of that kind of thinking. I don't think solstice, that our connection with our roots in this way has resonated with all peoples on the face of the earth. And when you think about it, this is one of those events that permeates all religions, all cultures. Like so many things, it's taken for granted. And I do think that if we're going to approximate a global culture, you know, the idea of Freemasonry, that the harmony, and mutual understanding, the commitment to work for the betterment of mankind, we are going to probably revisit and restore some of the ancient celebrations. Maybe you're confident enough to think of this period as the Druids and pagans, the so-called pagans. Pagans is a Christian term. It was needed back in the time when it was a little bit, whether the Protestants would prevail was a little bit, whether the Christians would prevail was a little dodgy. So we needed a little market push. So we created the them and us mentality. You can do your own study on that, of course, I know, but They also got into a really interesting dichotomy, good, evil, devil, God, you know, that kind of stuff. Interesting. Essential, I'd like to say so, but, you know, the solar day, you know, it's getting darker, but solar day is rarely 24 hours. Rarely, rarely. Sun sort of lags behind the clock for that part of the year, and then it speeds up for another part of the year. The length of the solar day does vary because the axis is tilted, so 23.5 degrees from vertical. Can you imagine that? Yeah. So you can't be held responsible for being a bit half a bubble off the level. And, you know, it speeds up. It fluctuates as it orbits the sun, as our Earth. And it accelerates when it's closer, which makes sense to our star. And the pull is greater. And then as it gets further away, it decelerates, so, you know, that's physics for you. It takes a while for the clock and the solar days to align, and the evenings draw in toward their earliest sunset a couple of weeks before the shortest day. Yeah, and the mornings continue to get darker for a couple more weeks. So, as my brother lovingly likes to refer to, who loves me dearly, those, and to all the pundits who think of Masonry as those devil worshiping sons of bitches, I'm afraid that your comments are misplaced, nor that we would have anything quite so unessential. One would expect those types of callousness, wouldn't we? With something as beautiful and harmonious as the principles of Freemasonry, of course, we would not be worth our salt, as we'd say, if it didn't inspire that type of rhetoric and criticism of the order. It gives us a bit of a cachet in a way. What do you say to, you know, if a fellows came to our door and saying, after all, the world is flat and we insist that you agree with that? Well, not so much. Not so much. I'm going to, don't know if I have it close at hand, but you do know that, if we're going to brag about the cultivation of North America, here's a little, you should know a little bit about the folks that we're bragging about. England's Puritans, remember? Cross the ships of Mayflower, all that stuff. This is, the Puritans were a bit of an odd lot. So I want you to think back to this period of time in 1644. The English Puritan politicians were battling with this legislation for 16 years to put an end to Christmas. Yep. They wanted the world codified. Dress a certain way. Can you think about parallels today? Think a certain way. Associating Christmas festivities with drunk access and, get this, papist superstition. The Protestant-dominated Long Parliament in England in 1644 ordered that Christmas be reserved for penitent fasting and not for giving liberty to carnal and sensual delights of food. A bit concrete, wouldn't you say? That ordinance set the stage for an outright ban on Christmas, or, as some Protestants refer to it, Christmastide, calling it to avoid the Catholic connotations of Mass. Don't want Christmas. So we call it Christtide. In 1647, sparking riots in Canterbury and rekindling sympathy for the royalist cause. Remember the period. The death of King Charles, 1649, and Oliver Cromwell's rise to power brought new crackdowns to prevent holiday celebrations. But within Britain, there were some who kept holding December 21st sermons and closing their stores clandestinely until 1660, when Charles' son was restored to the throne and Christmas was saved. These are the people that were piled onto the ships and headed for North America, claiming persecution in their homeland, the inability to worship as they chose. We always need to go back and wonder about these broad brush statements. The rhetoric about the loading all of your criminals and sending them to Australia. It's long been with us until you realize there's a nasty business going on. And if you and your clever little fork-tongued political pundits could get together, you could send your political prisoners to Australia. And that's what they did. And mocked them. Not the first time great people have been mocked, or good people have been mocked to serve a dark provision. But remember, when you're hearing about these things, just ask yourself the why of it, huh? Why did they come here? And make your own determinations. I don't think, even to this day, that I would subscribe to the notions of a Puritan Protestantism. Certainly in the day, you could see how dangerous that could be. 16 years. So when you think about zealots, I always think that we have those people have their zealots, and we have our zealots. It tires me to think that wars could be the basis of very withering minds who know how to create a catastrophe in the minds of otherwise good men, sufficient to vilify a fellow creature, a human being. That seems to have been the basis of war, going into war for a long, long time. That a capacity to sway people with the vilification, that there is a vilification. There's some people, those people are evil and need to be eliminated. So this time of year, I think, today, not at Christmas, that's maybe not my day for doing this, but around this period of Christmas is when I feel most generous, and I'd like to share that with you and have you consider it, but to reach out to the men and women who were part of this stain on our moral conscience, the Holocaust, and to all of their surviving children and their children's children, a promise that we will be vigilant so that it never happens again, and that the life of your family members taken in that distressful period will not only be valued, but never forgotten. And either are you. Not because you order it or you demand it. In fact, exactly the opposite. Because you deserve it. For all the women out there listening that are being harassed and beaten by their partners, rest assured, ma'am, we will find out. We always do. And we will take care of it best we can. But you're not forgotten either. Dark stains on our culture? Absolutely. But today, this period in our belief is when we collectively prevail. Try to mock it and make our holiday something that it isn't. Try as hard as you can to make it a commercial time. When we see witness those scenes of people motivated by little more than greed, I presume, men and women stampeding toward tables full of television screens and blue jeans. This is what we've come to. This is what we've come to. Those folks serve a purpose for us. Little reminder. That's the face of greed these days. This is when we prevail. When our passions and our principles and our philosophy of life are demonstrated. Because I reject that reality that says the world is going to hell. I absolutely reject that. The world is what it is. There is a place and a need for Freemasons more than ever. And that's the lament of a Freemason on this day for hundreds of years. You could always say the same thing. Is it any wonder we tinkered with this idea about belief? We had to know that we realized within the human mind we could not be restrained. Do away with a holiday. Well, a lot of people try to do that still. Puritans tried it. Thank goodness they failed. Do you remember everybody dressing in black with those little white collars? Do you remember that? That's the uniform of this faith. And a way of thinking came with it, and a way of being, and a way of being with each other. And a sense that this was the right way to live. And so all of you who weren't living the right way were living the wrong way. Really? Damn those Freemasons, eh? Never could get their head around that. Tell me, it's Christmas. It's Christmas. And depending on what calendar you use, Christmas is upon us or coming. You know, it's not that, it's not to be that glib, is it, to that we think about this. It's different things to different people, different time frames, different calendars used in the face of the earth. There is no right or wrong. It's like saying the color of your eyes is right or wrong. The beat of your heart is right or wrong. There are 3 days and 15 hours and 41 minutes until my Christmas. And if yours is a day earlier or a week later, bless you too. This is a time where those people that believe in harmony demonstrate it. Now, if you're locked away, ciphering through the news and bringing forward all the particles and scraps that you can weave into a menacing world image, lift your head up. Look at the sky. It's the solstice. Tomorrow, the day gets longer. Our sun restores life to our earth. We can survive. In your heart, search out for others that are like you, not playing in the mud looking for problems. My goodness, If we didn't have the longest night, we'd never have the shortest day. If we didn't have lightness, we wouldn't have darkness. If we didn't have pain, we wouldn't have joy. This is an exceptional period of life. I'm thinking about today about Marcus Aeneas Seneca, the Roman. Seneca the rhetorician. Rhetoric, the study of rhetoric, we've heard that term within the halls of a lodge. And that was a capacity to persuade. And we would go to school and learn from others that art of persuasion. Sure. He was my feeling was he's a bit of a nihilist, you know, as he says, nothing is infinite. A little deep, you could say, well, would you like jam with your toast there, Seneca? Nothing is infinite. All things death claims, 'tis law, not punishment to die. So you don't want another coffee? Is that what you're saying? But the one that I take a little more to heart today is, it is a sign of a great spirit to be moderate in prosperity. Nothing like the conspicuous display of the nouveau riche, the tasteless, unbounded, poor taste consumption. But the reason I bring him up today is for something that he's credited with saying that I truly believe is one of the threads in the apron of a good mason. If you want to be loved, love. It was again Plato who said, it is harder to forgive a friend than an enemy. But this fellow, Seneca, says, it is wrong not to give a hand to the fallen. This right is common to the whole human race. Some laws are not written. Natural law, but are more decisive than any written law, that premise of right and wrong. We don't need a constitution to understand right and wrong, to live in harmony. A good man knows how to do it. A fool, and that's why we have police and courts, because there are fools. But this boy said, let us drink, for we must die. Well, here's a little bit of eggnog. I don't know. I don't see this as empty calories. When I drink it, it always fills me up. But I nicely digress. You're here to learn about secrets within the craft, I hope. Again, I've been paying attention to those conversations. Those conversations as we stand up, and we stand in the north where all lofty conversation occurs. In the Tudor period, alchemists practiced their arts. To this day, we know scientists are protective and secretive about their work. Across Canada, the scientific community has been targeted for a decade and more by the current federal government, pushing an ideological agenda. They restrict and censor and filter research results, claiming that if the public purse, oh no, it's more, claiming that if they've paid for it, meaning the government of the day, then they control the distribution of it. In fact, you and I paid for it. Those talking heads are just that. We have a majority government here in Canada of 39%. It's scary. Now think about what they're doing with research. Understand why the major researchers across this country, research that has built on the integrity of independence, to look up, to provide and develop objective truths. How sad and an oxymoronic that one is. objective truths to be replaced, to be pushed back by a government ideology. Not now. We don't want to know about the tar sands. Our record for clear-cutting of all the developed nations, Canada is doing the most. They'll be gone. They'll be gone soon, like all politicians do. They come and go. They fight and struggle to keep things the way it is so that they can remain in power. That's their job, not necessarily to serve you and I. But we're going to be left with a legacy behind them. It's already falling apart, isn't it? Another one of these temporary stunts that they call prosperity. Except for all that prosperity, somehow we always end up paying for it, don't we? Think back to the Tudor period. Yeah, think back to it. That was, just in case that you're forgotten, the Tudor period was a time between 1485 and 1603. This is around the end of what was called the Great Interruption. The Renaissance was the onset of the Renaissance. The Great Interruption was from about 400 AD to 1400. And it was the period when the interruption was with science, that the translation, if we wanted to know about science, we turned to religion to help us translate the world and the science around us. Now that worked in those moments when faith and science were the same, and it did happen in our history. But for 1,000 years, there was a suppression of the knowledge. What science is new knowledge, a new understanding. And when we have new ideas and new understanding, we can make decisions, take those into account, avoid complications. So that period had just come to an end. And the Tudor period came about. And it coincides with the rule of the Tudor dynasty in England. Think of this as Henry VII, right? He was a little bit buttoned down. England was doing well and economically, and it was, you know, that imperialism. Yeah, well, it was sort of unbounded. It had been for a while. And things were optimistic under the Tudors. And this had just come in after the Black Death, and then there was a terrible agricultural depression in the late 15th century. This is when the population actually began to increase again. The export of woolen products, England was known for good quality wool, and that presented, you know, opportunity, trade opportunity. So our merchants, of the day, were visiting Midland Europe. And Henry VII, in 1498, he negotiated something called the Intercursus Magnus. And that's a major and long-lasting commercial treaty that he signed in February 1496 with Philip IV, the Duke of Burgundy. And the other signatures on it, though, came from Venice and Florence and the Netherlands and the Hanseatic, the German area. So the Holy Roman Empire was involved in that, Republic of Venice, Dutch Republic, Burgundian Netherlands. Yeah. This was around the War of the Roses. And that was a series of dynastic civil wars between two cadet branches of the House of Plantagenet. And they had been fought between 1455 and 1485. 30 years. Like, get over it. The Lancastrian Henry Tudor defeated the Yorkist King Richard III of Bosworth Field. And then he married Elizabeth of York. She happened to be the daughter of Edward IV. And sister of the princes in the Tower. So to unite that was done to unite the two houses. And in 1490, the young Flem, Perkin Warbeck, appeared and claimed to be Richard, the younger of the Yorkist princes in the Tower, and thus a pretender to the English crown. But things being what they were, in a year, 2 years later, in 93, Warbeck won the support of Edward IV's sister, Margaret, the Dowager Princess of Burgundy. She allowed him to remain in her court and gave him 2,000 mercenaries. Nice little perk. Hang around. By the way, would you like 2,000 soldiers? So, but that's the Intercursus Magnus. Now back to the storyline. Think back to the Tudor period and governments when governments had less leverage and more obfuscation with those pesky alchemists. They did and did not keep their work secret. Yes, they did not want others to replicate their findings. Just like the scientists today, they're perfect. They're protective, not perfect, they're protective. Because findings can be stolen. If you've worked very hard to come up with a calculation or a discovery, and this happens all the time. Oh, little Tommy Edison was notorious for this kind of thing. All hail Tommy Edison, eh? A little bit of a thief. Buddy, the winner, it's about winning. That's what's most important, isn't it? It's not about how you got there, whether there was honesty or deceit behind it. It's all about winning. We might want to look through the work of Tesla to see what we lost by following that little marketeer, that little bendito, Tommy Edison. Yes, they did not want others to replicate their findings. That makes sense. This is from the same protectionist thinking that gave rise to passwords and signs of recognition and operative masons. So before we clamor all over this, we should say, well, you know, there's some upside to it. We're using those similar kind of thinking. The alchemist had to keep track of his work, which he did by developing and writing in code. Decipher the code, follow the research. Within the craft, we have often heard what I like to think of as the declaration of the uninformed. We are not a secret society, but we do have secrets. There are 27,000 languages in use on this blue globe orbiting our star. We happen to use an obscure language to keep track of our work. Study the language for yourself. The information becomes obvious. Mason with a loose, waggy tongue can't be of much use. The Rosetta Stone to translate these glyphs is yet to be found. Isn't it curious that alchemists have continued to practice and no one sees fit to indict? To all those who cannot control their emotion, you will look for an apology for the frustration that causes a blind rage around the lodge. So here is a bone. If you desire what alchemists seek, if you can commit, if you have the ability to go beyond your familiar logical mind, find a book about the Kabbalah. If your mind is settled enough to know that the alchemist's secrets are anything but the revelations of truth, the path may open. It's all there. Open secrets hidden in open view. Trying to understand and study alchemy without being an alchemist, it's like, I think, trying to understand physics without being a physicist. Are you finding secrets? Yep. Can I read a book about your secrets? No. Can I read a book about you? Yeah. What will it tell me about your work? Just the basics. Just the basics. Just enough that you can laugh at the work, not take it all too serious, not be too threatened by it either. Simple. Who would have thought? So the secrets within the craft as they often are all around us. For the inquisitive mind, it's like anything else in life, isn't it? It's like the artificers. It's easy to come up with solutions if you know what you're looking for. Similarly with alchemy, if you know what to look for, it's all around. In the ritual, oh my goodness, yes. In the ritual of the rites, the York and the Scottish, oh my goodness, yes. In the Rosicrucians, yeah. The Martinists, yeah. Yep, it's all there. But in order to understand it, requires a suspension of the way that you look at the world around. You can't approach this understanding and keep thinking the way you think today. Alchemy, the alchemists had went beyond that. For me, what I find difficult and struggled with was, let's take something fairly populous, okay, the lodestone, and the idea that we could turn lead into gold. Well, I immediately thought that was just fanciful. And then I began to wonder about the difference between taking that type of statement and trying to understand it metaphorically as compared to a literal translation. Well, of course I would think that way, because that's the way I look at that scripture. You can look at it literally, or you could look at it in terms of the allegory and metaphoric stories and messages that it contains. And they all do contain some important, I think, important metaphorical message. But remember, this is coming from a person that cannot find justification to kill another person. I can't be taught that. I have that inside me, just like you do. That's not something you teach. That's something you trigger. So, the alchemist dreaming? What does the alchemist dream? That's the question I puzzle over. It means changing, suspending, altering a way of thinking that has been part of me, I, you, from the moment we were born. It's transcending that, going somewhere in our minds, somewhere else in our minds. And you can see the wizardry. These were men that created their own, and women, yeah, that created their own language. And then within that, a code to use to describe their findings. So the rascals could leave these notes around, and who could cipher them? I still am fascinated when I see the instruments of an alchemist's lab. Isaac Newton, yeah. Were the alchemists active? I don't think, you know, that when the Royal Society was being formed, that we were seeing the alchemists sitting in a corner saying, no, we're a lobby group, and this is the principles that we think should be instilled in the Royal Society. And then having a few of the boys sit there and say, well, you know, we should start a society. Well, we already had those societies started in the coffee houses in London. And I'm going to get into that historical connection at another time. But what I think is really essential, as we pull back, is that there are layers and layers of understanding and layers of reality. And your reality may reject mine may reject yours, but they're colored by the principles and philosophies of the arts and sciences. And that's one of the secrets within the craft. And that's my rant for the day. It's you guys can fast forward this if you don't. Like, I just want to get, a little bit of the Christmas, what's up at Christmas kind of thing. This is an old tune. And it's shut up, Dale. 19th century stuff. Like that. Old tune, huh? Old tune. Wouldn't be Masonic Home Companion. I hope I'm talking to fellows that are deliberate recluses. I hope so. If you want to be out there in your best suit, being all fancy, go ahead and do that. But if you're of a little more humble stock, then come walk through the woods with Cyril and I, and listen to our conversation, and join in if you want. By all means, no need to talk because you feel you need to say something. But if you have something to say, jump right in. And as far as posturing and trying to present yourself as something that you're not. Cyril is an old boy, and he has an ability to read character. So you don't have to do that. Makes you look foolish. I want to talk a bit about, I'm just astounded at the amount of material that comes to us today in the 21st century. I still hear a bit of whining and complaining about, not being able to catch up with modern technology and being worried that, and, you know, still I hear some boys talking about almost proudly that they're not involved with the internet. Well, you know, when I was a little boy, I was taught to write with a pencil, one of those big thick things about the size of your finger. So you could run a Buick over it, you wouldn't break the lead on that puppy. And then you went from that to a straight nib pen with an inkwell. Remember? Sure, come on, some of you do. And you had a bottle of ink, and a blotting paper. And for a boy that's left-handed, you failed the penmanship courses regularly because you couldn't follow the instruction that the expert teacher in front of you was teaching to the class because they simply hadn't figured out how to teach a left-handed boy how to write with wet ink. So I taught myself how to do it without dragging my hand through all that goo and turning out a reasonable script. So I know that when I think about people that are a little bit turning their nose up at the internet and new technology, I'm thinking, well, you daft dog thing. Are you still using an inkwell and you're still using that? I went from that straight pen to a fountain pen. I thought that was an amazing bit of technology. I still carry one today. I still write with a fountain pen. It's just my pen of choice. And then we quickly went from that to, remember when the very first ballpoint pens came in? And they were revered little tools. You make sure you don't drop it. Anyway, when I think about this, when I think about it, choosing not to use the internet to me is like choosing not to use a ballpoint pen. It wasn't the same as a straight pen, and I suppose was not the same as a quill, if we want to get back to it. But it was just easier. Could do the same job, and it was smarter. I don't hear any of the old boys saying, give me a 1953 Chevy Biscayne. No, I don't need those power brakes, and I don't need that power steering, and I don't need air conditioning. No, and get that padding off the dash. I'm fine with just steel plate there. And bias ply tires, I really don't need that. I've done quite well driving without them. Thank you very much. And then, why should I wash my hands before I eat? I've never done that before. Why would I ever think that, you know, all those viruses and bacteria that I'm taking in are coming from my own hands? I've never done it before. New technology. And to turn down something that is, you know, defining. I liken the men that talk like this to a time when the press was being developed. Just think, when the printing press was being developed, these would be the boys saying, oh, I've always read my manuscripts done in cursor. It was good enough for my grandfather. It's good enough for me. I'm not going to be buying a printed book. I don't need that new thing, that new aberration. I think that when you do this type of thing, I don't mean because of an infirmity, and not at all. And not at all because of you don't have the means, not at all. But to do it deliberately makes that person seem irrelevant, because I would always wonder, if you were hooked up and you weren't so afraid of a ballpoint pen, what would you be writing? What would you be reading? And as you studied through the internet, you have access to the major libraries and ideas around the world. Don't have to hop on a plane anymore, rent a hotel room, and make appointments to go and wander through the Louvre. I can do that in front of me. But what it does is it changes our perspective. This, I can assure you, gentlemen, is beyond the wildest dreams of our forefathers, because it is so absolutely amazing. And we haven't seen the end of it yet. We're still trying to figure out how to sort it out and control it. We know that it's not going to be left to the fault lines of governments to do. Thank you. And they found their own devils. Hackers. The danger of the hackers. Do I know a secret? Sony started lifted up their kilts to these hackers. The hackers were upset about something Sony did. I'll leave it to you to go and find out what Sony did. But to my mind, they were getting a little greedy. Hackers talked to them, didn't pay much attention. Instead, Sony started flexing. All that muscular nonsense. Hackers began sitting up, saying, "Don't do that." Sony not only did it, but they added to it. Who are you to talk to us? This is ours. Well, what I think has happened is that they haven't learned the lessons yet of humility, or to say they made a mistake and then everybody can go their separate way. These hackers are so clever, they've made it all look like it's coming from North Korea. The North Koreans said, "Gee, you know, should we take credit for this? Did you do this?" No, it wasn't us. So who's sitting back laughing at whom? There's no laughter. It's like you want the power of the internet is always going to be independent. Listen to me. Aren't I just speaking outside of my position in life? The genius is out there. It's not within a government or within a military. It's out there. Maybe it's your sons or daughters. Genius has always been beyond control, hasn't it? Now we know. We'll keep an eye and see how this play unravels in front of us. It should be very, very interesting, I think. We're going to talk. Can you mind? It wouldn't be a Masonic Home Companion unless we went for a walk and talked a little bit about things Masonic. And we've been introducing the idea of whether this is all just a bit of a fruitless effort. What we're talking about is the creation or the development or the goal being utopia. Utopia is always that something just beyond the grasp of a man. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? Are we? So I ask you that. Everybody doesn't shine their shoes when they go to a lodge. Everybody doesn't press their pants. Everybody doesn't know exactly when to speak or when to shut up. For some, having an opportunity to be recognized is just fuel for a little ego. And it's painful to watch it, isn't it? It is what it is. And you easily misunderstood. Even if, and I can attest to this, even if your motivations have little to do with personal ambition, you'll be accused of that. Because, after all, there are no altruists left. There are no people motivated by the well-being of others. It's just surprising when you hear people do that, who they are. So I'm going back a little past the Tudor period, of course, into the 17th century here to talk to you about the word architect. Yeah. In 1659, the word architect carried the definition of one who defines and frames any complex structure, especially the creator. The creator was an architect, linking the language of the first degree very firmly to the language of the age. By the same token, it also urges speculation as a key to knowledge. Linking language to the age means that if I use your local traditions, your local attempts at translating, using the language in a different way than what it was in the 17th century, then I'm missing the point. Flat out. My goodness, am I an ancient? I think I'm turning into marble here. But of course, Cyril would just look at me and shake his head and say, "What in the world are you talking about?" And then I feel self-conscious and stop that stupid talk. Toward the end, by the same token, it also urges speculation as a key to knowledge. I have to question. Towards the end of the 17th century and in the opening years of the 18th, a subtle change seems to have taken place among philosophers, speculating on the nature of utopia. Previous writers had devised an ideal social framework and then designed strategies to create and enforce it. The newly emergent theme asked effectively, what are the obstacles to the creation of a perfect society? De Foigny, this is a fellow born in 1630, and he died in 1692. So he lived when all that nonsense with the Charles after their head with Cromwell, you know, I like me, so follow me, what happened, De Foigny expounded a near-Masonic viewpoint in a new discovery of Terra Incognita Australis. He addressed the question, how can men live in brotherly accord? He concluded that it would be necessary to remove those fundamental elements of discord: possessions, money, and women. After a lengthy analysis of how this could be achieved, which in part owes much to Genesis, he concluded that mercy and joy are as deeply rooted in human passions as are vice and lust. Pure reason is as incompatible with happiness and love as are the animal appetites he condemns. In such logic lie the roots of Freemasonry as a moral code by which to live. Here are to be found the first stirrings of prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice. De Foigny's cry, I'll spell that out for you. It's capital D, small e, space, capital F, O-I-G-N-Y. De Foigny's cry is that man must know himself. He's been dating the Delphi Oracle, hasn't he? And curb his animal appetites or passions if he is to find a pathway to happiness and brotherly love. Damn, I love those animal appetites and passions. And whose round is it? Damn, you hate that. There's so much fun in those animal appetites. Give me the football, coach. Give me the ball. I'll run for the line. If we want to find a pathway to happiness and brotherly love, we have to control those things. Smart man. His use of the word passion reflects his training as a monk, where passion signified agony. Passion plays, eh? Passion as love first appeared in 1588 in Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus. When De Foigny was writing, it had come to mean a strong liking of the source that prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice must control if a man is to achieve his true destiny and rise above his baser instincts. God, I hate that. There he goes, making not only making the point, but making me appreciate it. Ugh. Making me understand it. Damn you, De Foigny. You know, I bet you the guy never had a drink in his life. And here he is saying, if I'm going to achieve my true destiny, I need to do these things. Wow. The term know thyself takes on a new, a different meaning for a Mason that's in this kind of frame of mind. You ever wonder what you like if you can control those passions? The suggestion is it's closer to a utopian way of thinking about yourself. And my goodness, that has to be better. But what is he saying to us, Cyril? Is he saying that I'm plagued by this sense of shortcomings? I have to be able to change my suit and my way of thinking? Is this like going to sleep with the Carl Jungian notion in my mind before I fade off? To ask to find tonight in my dreams, to find my true nature. That notion that you can guide your dreams. Must be a fool talking, Cyril. The words that we use, the meaning of the words that we use changes from time to time. There would be peril then in assuming the way we think today is the way that men thought when they were writing those words hundreds of years ago. But who would know? Only men that had realized that caveat. You have to take things in context. What is chauvinism today was not necessarily chauvinism before. Just because we cling to a value from a time past does not mean that that value is legitimate in today's environment. Cyril is a taller man and takes a bigger stride than me, so all that's saying is, keep up, Dale. Hurry up. You have to move your legs a little faster to keep up. As far as your mind, that doesn't have to move any faster. There's nothing at all wrong with your mind. It's gaining focus, getting some control of your baser instincts as animal appetites, and being serious about it. Where do I go to be serious about it? Well, you can always come to Masonic Home Companion. Nobody will see you twisting in your chair. I'm just going to be embarrassed if you talk to yourself. Cyril does it. He's making sense to himself. He's working through his ideas. Dale knows that's referred to as cognitive rehearsal. And the rest laugh at it. Good. Get a lot of laughter. People laugh and mock and are afraid of things they don't understand. All darkness is bad. Emanuel Swedenborg was born in 1688. He was a distinguished Swedish mystic. You'll like this guy. And this will bridge nicely with some of that other talk about those alchemists. He had a varied career, but listen, he was a scientist. And he underwent a religious crisis in which he claimed to have been given a direct insight into the spiritual world. Swedenborg argued that humans exist simultaneously in both the physical and spiritual world. Now, there's a lot of listeners out there. I know you, and I would love to sit down and talk with you about this point. The next time we see each other, whether we've got a bevy or a coffee in hand, I would like to sit down and talk, get your feedback on that one, that we exist in different planes at the same time. both the physical and spiritual world, but that only the memory of the spiritual world survives after death. The core of Swedenborg's thesis was that God, as the supreme being, is neither transcendental nor immanent or out there, but within ourselves. Oh, we have got to talk about this one. I need your opinions on that, certainly. The Creator exists inside of us. And I would say not necessarily inside of the body, but inside of the mind. Cyril's looking at me a little bit askance, but he's listening. This was also the case with heaven and hell. This view accords neatly with the thrust of the charge after the rising in the third degree and attracted popular support among his followers in London, who in 1787 established the Church of the New Jerusalem, which spread worldwide, advancing the creed of Swedenborgianism. Its fundamental tenet was that redemption is concerned solely with personal striving in the spiritual life. Following the guidance set down in Holy Writ and aligning that search with charity towards all. Freemasonry has never offered redemption, but its main quest has always been for keys to self-knowledge, personal improvement and betterment in thought, word, and deed. Consider the importance of the words spoken during the explanation of the three great lights to the Master Elect. As a well-read thinking man, Preston could not have been unaware of Swedenborg's writings. Indeed, what can be discerned in Preston's work is a thread which suggests that the lessons of Freemasonry, as exemplified by the explanations of the working tools and elsewhere, serve to fashion that memory of the spiritual world which Swedenborg believed survives death. His immortal soul will then partake of the joys which have been prepared for the righteous from the beginning of the world. That last quote is from The Illustrations of Masonry, page 109, by Preston in his Illustrations of Masonry. What do you think? Have I earned my keep this morning, today, this afternoon, this evening? It's something I'd like you to, I hope, draws on ideas that you have had and you're left to your own contemplations. It's good that you came to Masonic Home Companion today. It wouldn't be the same without you. You know, it certainly wouldn't be the same without you. Now, it's the season. We're coming up to Christmas. I may do a Christmas show. I hope so. Take a look for it. I may. If I can get the time, I'll do a Christmas show. I hope, truly, that you bring forward all of the best thoughts that you have about humanity and the world that we live in and the universe that we live in. And let that belief be with you through this period of Christmas, a period of giving. And as we've just heard, present yourself to yourself as a man well thought of. Think of yourself well. You are, if you believe what Swedenborg believed in a way, self-made. The Creator being in us, in every cell, in every molecule. The genius, the magic and mystery. And let that determine your actions and attitude toward all people during this Christmas season. And that spirit that you find and that you bring forward, I hope will linger with you for all time. Merry Christmas. Thanks for being here. This is a little treat. This is a Huron carol. This is the first Canadian Christmas hymn, our oldest song. It's written around 1642 by Jean de Brébeuf, a Jesuit missionary at Saint Marie among the Hurons up in Midland. It's from the melody. It's from an old traditional, a traditional French folk song, Une jeune puce, a young maid. Here's a little bit of gossip. The well-known English lyrics were written in 1926 by Jesse Edgar Middleton, and the copyright to those lyrics were held by the Frederick Harris Music Company until they entered the public domain in 2011. In the English version, Jesus is born in a lodge of broken bark wrapped in a robe of rabbit skin, and he's surrounded by hunters instead of shepherds. And the Magi are portrayed as chiefs from afar who bring him fox and beaver pelts instead of the more familiar gold and frankincense and myrrh. The hymn also uses the traditional Algonquin name, Kichi Manitou, for God. See what you think. It's a beautiful little song, and it's a tune you'll remember well. Our Canadian Christmas Carol. Thank you.
again.
Almost got there.